From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Karen Grigsby Bates, in for Arun Roth. In this episode, straight talk on Iraq and Afghanistan from Army Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger.
Thanks to our problem, now all of America has a problem. To wit, two lost campaigns and a war gone awry.
A new study explores why women's wages go down when their weight goes up.
I think there's certainly a conception that obese men are somehow different than obese women.
James Earl Jones's big break.
Some of the most famous off-Broadway theaters you can imagine, I watched the toilets in those places.
And after a six-year hiatus, new music from Bette Midler.
My myth is to shame. Please let me explain.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Even as the nation honors veterans, past and present, for their service, a new group of men and women will be preparing to head to Iraq. On Friday, President Obama authorized the deployment of 1,500 more troops to Iraq to provide advisory support. That will bring the total up to over 3,000, this 3 years after the military's official withdrawal from that country in 2011. Army Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger helped lead the strategy in Iraq and Afghanistan up through his retirement last year.
I'm a United States Army general, and I lost the global war on terrorism.
These are the first few words of his new book called Why We Lost.
It's like Alcoholics Anonymous. Step one's admitting you have a problem. Well, I have a problem. So do my peers. And thanks to our problem, now all of America has a problem. To wit, two lost campaigns and a war gone awry.
I spoke with the retired three-star general earlier this week. He said conflicting agendas in all three countries and the lingering specter of Vietnam would complicate both campaigns. But he told me he had his first inklings of trouble earlier on.
What I saw almost immediately was trouble figuring out who the enemy was. So we knew within a day or two of the 9/11 attacks that it was Al-Qaeda, a terrorist network that had a headquarters element, if you will call it that, or a chairman of the board in Osama bin Laden. And they were operating out of Afghanistan. But that's not who we ended up fighting most of the time. Sure, we went after Al-Qaeda at times, but we ended up fighting the Taliban, which were Pashtun people in Afghanistan who were trying to run that country, and then we evicted them in 2001. And we ended up fighting Sunni Arab insurgents in Iraq, who again, although they might make common cause with Al-Qaeda, those weren't the guys who attacked us on 9/11.
So we had an enemy, or several enemies at one point, but we didn't exactly know a whole lot about them. Don't we normally figure this out before we start to send troops over to do fighting?
Well, yes. One of the things that we often say in the military is you have to fight for information or fight for intelligence. So as we developed this picture and it became obvious that we were fighting an insurgent enemy mixed into a civil population that was suspicious of us anyway as outsiders, and that was true in both Afghanistan and Iraq, it really brought up the second point, which is, what is the U.S. military trained to do? And the U.S. military is trained to carry out short and decisive conventional operations against a uniform formed enemy. So if you want us to go in and do something along the lines of 1991 Desert Storm, where we go against armored divisions and Air Force squadrons of the Iraqi forces and destroy them and capture the remainder, that's what we're trained to do. It's very, very difficult to take even the great troops that we have and send them into a village to try and sort out which of the males there, the young males, might be insurgents, who might be just people living in the area, who might potentially be government supporters when you don't speak the language and you really don't understand what's going on in that village very well.
Just about 2 years ago, almost to the day, you announced during a Veterans Day ceremony that, quote, our nations count on us and will deliver. Seems like while you were there, you thought this could be successful. Given those early misgivings, what made you think that maybe this might happen?
Well, I think what made me think it was successful is we really had two ways we could prosecute this war. The first was essentially to do what we did in Desert Storm, and both Afghanistan and Iraq started with a very short, successful, decisive U.S. initial invasion. And at that point, we had the option we could have backed out and left it to the local people to sort it out. And it might have been sort of ugly and it might have been sort of unsatisfying. But in both cases, we didn't do that. We decided to stay. The only way you can win that is the local people have to take the lead and they have to have the sure knowledge that they got a long-term U.S. commitment to help them in the things they have trouble with. And when I made that statement at Veterans Day, I was hopeful that the United States would make a long-term commitment to both countries. It seems like in Iraq, we're going to have a degree of a commitment more than we probably thought we would in the fall of 2011, based on their fight against ISIS and what we're trying to do to help them now. Afghanistan, though, I keep hearing the same noises about we're going to draw down to just an embassy and a few hundred people there within a year or so.
When we had a chance to make a clean-cut decision about we either turn it over to the people that live there or throw everything into it and make a decision to be there for a long time, I'm wondering what you thought was the best approach, the best decision in terms of how that might go.
Given what I knew then, I would have recommended to do like we did in 1991 and turn it over to the local folks. You know, give them some backing, but not much beyond the embassy or maybe a couple hundred advisors or something. No, certainly not hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground for 10 years.
Finally, you're retired now. Your part in this is over. Why write this book? Because I suspect it's going to ruffle some feathers. Why not go play golf or fish or something? This might cost you a little bit.
It might, but whatever cost it costs me would be so minor compared to those who've lost their lives and families that have been disrupted and devastated by the cost of this war. The bravery and sacrifice of the people that I was privileged to serve with should be saluted. And the mistakes, the errors made by guys like me have to be accounted for and explained so we can learn and do better in the event we have to do something like this again.
That's retired Army Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger, whose new book is called Why We Lost, and is out on Tuesday. General, thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen.
Hear that? That's what our planet sounds like from space. And that's lightning on Jupiter. NASA recently dipped into its sound archive and dusted off over 60 recordings from the past 50 years of space exploration. It's uploaded all the sounds to SoundCloud, an online audio distribution site where you can listen to and download the entire library for free. There are some historic sounds you might expect, like...
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. The Eagle has landed.
But then there are others that are kind of mind-bending. That's the sound of Enceladus, one of Saturn's many moons spewing out massive plumes of water vapor from its icy surface. And here are the sounds of Saturn's colorful auroras. But wait, how's it possible to hear light? And how is it that NASA was able to record sounds in space where sound doesn't exist? Well, scientists can sonify non-auditory data by assigning noises to their different values. So patterns in silent light waves become the sound of starlight. Jason Townsend is NASA's deputy social media manager. He says since NASA's space probe Voyager 1 escaped the sun's magnetic fields, it's been able to collect data from outside our solar system.
One of the other sounds that's really kind of far out, actually, is from one of our Voyager probes, which is out there right now in between the stars, known as interstellar space. And so it actually collected data that is the sound of interstellar plasma. And so that's a really interesting sound that's literally from the object that's the most distant from Earth of a man-made object ever.
Townsend says you can even hear the sounds of the future, so to speak.
Our space launch system, better known as SLS, they are right now doing all sorts of testing. And one of the sounds is of an acoustic test fire. And so that's a rocket that's going to carry us deeper and further than we've ever gone in space before. And it's going to go out past the moon and potentially take humans to Mars.
3, 2, 1.
The National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958 requires NASA to share its work and findings with as many people as possible.
And so, you know, things like social media and SoundCloud and everything are just the latest step in that journey.
Townsend hopes that people, especially musicians and producers, will get creative with the sound library.
If you're a DJ and you're looking for a sound that, you know, may be literally out of this world, you know, one of these NASA sounds may be completely appropriate for that.
Or perhaps just use them for even more terrestrial purposes.
Such as make them into a ringtone for your phone or, you know, make them into things like computer alert sounds. I mean, it'd be kind of cool if every time you have an error message pop up on your computer, it would say, Houston, we've had a problem.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main beam bus undervolt.
Roger, main beam undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
Overweight women make less money than their thinner peers. They also make less money than similarly overweight men. A new study set out to see why. Jennifer Chenal teaches law at Vanderbilt University. She's the lead author of the study, and she says the first problem is the type of work available to overweight women.
Well, what my research indicates is that obese women are more likely to work in physical activity jobs and less likely to work in personal interaction jobs. Now, the reason that that's important is that personal interaction jobs pay more on average than physical activity jobs. On the flip side, physical activity jobs pay less on average.
Describe some of these jobs for us. What do you mean when you say personal interaction jobs as opposed to demanding activity jobs?
So personal interaction jobs are jobs that require a high level of communication with others. So some of the characteristics I look at in my study are the amount of interaction you have with the public, how important communication with others is to your jobs, how important sales is to your jobs, how important interpersonal relationships are to your job. And so examples of occupations where things like that would be important, of course, are things like sales, reception, any kind of job where you will be called to be the face of the company.
Interestingly, as you say this, I'm just thinking, you know, I've sat in doctor's offices waiting for a physical, whatever, and you see reps for pharmaceutical companies come in, and I have never seen a really overweight woman dragging a samples case. It's always been women who look like what you would think the 1960s flight attendant would look like. So you're saying that's not an accident.
It certainly doesn't seem to be an accident, and it's certainly consistent with what my research is finding.
But you're saying that obese men, similarly obese men, do not find their options narrowed this way. What does your research suggest is the reason for that?
Well, I think my research is highly suggestive of sex-based discrimination. Employers don't mind if an obese man is the face of their company. But they have a very different attitude towards obese women.
I'm wondering if part of that goes back to the turn of the last century when obese men were considered powerful and prosperous, and it was desirable in some ways to look that way. When you think of William Howard Taft and how huge he was, perhaps there is, or people don't think about a corollary for women. They don't think of being large and lush as necessarily desirable, even, let alone powerful.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. There's certainly seems to be different standards for men's appearance versus women's appearance. An anecdote that I often like to share is when I presented this research at a conference a few months ago, one response from an audience member was, well, this research makes absolute sense to me. Fat guys are fun. So I think there's also a sense of personality traits that go along with obesity may be different between men and women as well. Whether that's true or not, you know, who knows? But I think there's certainly a conception that obese men are somehow different than obese women.
Jennifer Chenal teaches at Vanderbilt Law School and joined us from their campus in Nashville. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The FBI file on jewel thief Doris Payne is said to be more than 6 feet long. The tall, thin black woman is known for using her charm, elegance, and a specialized sleight of hand to disarm clerks and walk out with precious jewels. Over her 60-year career, she's thought to have stolen $2 million in jewelry.
My methodology of stealing jewelry took me all over the world. Go to New York, Milan, Paris, Rome.
That's a clip from the documentary The Life and Crimes of Doris Payne. The film takes us from Payne's impoverished beginnings in West Virginia and to a lavish life on the run. Now 84 years old, Payne has been in and out of jail dozens of times, including earlier this year. The film follows Payne through one of her most recent trials in 2011, where she ended up spending 2.5 years in jail. Matthew Pond is the co-director and producer of the documentary, The Life and Crimes of Doris Payne. Eunetta Boone is a screenwriter who has researched Payne's life extensively and is featured in the documentary. They're both with me here at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Hi.
Matthew Pond, when you all started this, what were your impressions when you met her, you know, when you just eyeballed her? What did you think?
So I actually met her in jail in Orange County, and I would visit her on a weekly basis. She was behind a glass partition, and I was immediately struck by her charm and the fact that even at that time, she was in her late 70s, there was a real childlike quality to her. We developed this relationship over a period of months. She was released, and my filmmaking partner and I filmed her for a period of a year. She went to San Diego, and she was convicted of stealing a diamond down there. So we followed the trial.
Talk about her charm, because to take out trays of diamond rings and just lay them in front of her, and inevitably she would leave with a little something for herself. How did she do that?
I think the easy answer to that question is that Doris is fearless. And I think that's a double-edged sword for her. You know, it gives her the ability to go into Cartier and steal a 10-carat diamond. But she's also aware of what it's like to be in jail, and she's not afraid of it.
I think Doris really thinks she's an actress. I really think that she thinks she's playing the part of Doris Payne. Actually, I would argue that Matthew and I don't really know her at all. We know the person as she has presented to us.
I want to ask you about a scene toward the end of the film where you and Doris are talking. There's a glass that separates you. You're talking on the phone. And at some point, she just leans in and says to you, "Hello, I am speaking in English. Yes, I did it. I took it." Were you surprised?
Yeah, that scene was shocking and surprising to us. We were never really sure whether she took this diamond. And she swore black and blue to her children, to her lawyer, to us, to anyone that would listen, that although she was a jewel thief, she wasn't guilty of that particular crime.
She wasn't the thief of that jewel.
Right.
Yeah.
So when she finally did fess up, it made us realize, you know, she had the last laugh.
She gave your movie the ending that it needed, and she knew she was doing that. Mm-hmm. One of the things I always say, which I said to Matthew, you have to be very careful not to fall in love with her.
I want to ask you about that. So what do you mean when you say that? Because you're saying that despite whatever the psychology of doing what she does is, she's so fearless. And
she's
so,
got balls.
Yeah.
And this is the same woman that dealt a different set of cards, could have probably changed the world.
It's one of the many paradoxes of Doris Payne and why some people find her very likable, because I think they admire her chutzpah.
Did you feel suckered in at the end?
Of course I did, yeah. I mean, it's one thing to see an old woman in jail and to realize that we'd been played. That was a hard thing to deal with.
Where is Doris now?
So Doris is living in Long Beach, Southern California. She is spending nights in hotels, in Greyhound bus stations. There's none of the money left.
And you can't be a punk and do that.
Jeez. And live on the street.
Yeah. Yeah. She just celebrated her 84th birthday a couple weeks back.
Has Doris seen the film? Does she know how all of this turns out on film?
Doris has seen the film, and I was very nervous before I showed it to her. There are depictions of her that aren't particularly flattering. And she, halfway through it, stopped and said, "Could we go get a bite to eat now?" So she was really not so interested in her entire story. She really lives in the moment. So we went to get a bite to eat and came back and finished the film. And she liked it. She seemed to like it.
Matthew Pond is the co-director and producer of the documentary The Life and Crimes of Doris Payne. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And screenwriter Yunetta Boone, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
This documentary will air Sunday night on Al Jazeera America. The emperor penguin seen in movies like March of the Penguins and Happy Feet are elegant. The chicks are adorable. These penguins are also quite shy and skittish around humans. Many tracked penguins have data collecting devices underneath their skin. Usually, researchers have to get close to them to pick up a signal from the devices, and that freaks the penguins out. Yvonne Le Mau from the University of Strasbourg has been studying penguins for more than 40 years. He tried to tackle the problem.
I thought maybe we can use rovers.
A rover, a remote-controlled wheeled device disguised as a penguin that could infiltrate the colony. Turns out, it worked. Le Mau and his team equipped some penguins with heart monitors and saw that when the rovers approached, instead of humans, stress levels stayed low.
When a rover is approaching, the increase in heart rate is about the same that the bird has when another penguin is passing by.
But the disguise has to be good.
If you want to confuse the birds with fake penguins, it should be very, very well designed.
Le Mau had designed a fiberglass penguin, but the penguins didn't buy it. To get in, the rover penguin had to really look the part. Turns out, this is a story about scientists and filmmakers joining forces. See, at the same time, a UK-based production company was working on shooting a film using camouflage cameras to get into penguin colonies.
It was like a marriage in heaven.
Philip Dalton is the producer of the BBC film Penguins, Spy in the Huddle. He works for John Downer Productions, which specializes in designing spy cams to get unique shots in lots of environments. A team of engineers and model makers work to get the feathers, the coloring, the wheels just right. After a few model tweaks, they made a fluffy baby penguin, a chick cam, and happily it was accepted into the colony.
You get this wonderful perspective, which is very similar to what it must look like if you are a chick yourself.
Other penguins even tried to sing to it. Here's a clip from the 2013 miniseries Spy in the Huddle.
One even tries to take the spy cam under her wing.
With this special access, the chick cam got a shot of an emperor penguin laying an egg, a moment that hadn't been captured before. TV gold, for sure. But the chick cam also produced some important science.
I think in the year that we were there, with over 1,000 hours of footage that we gathered with our penguin cams, that was an equivalent of about, I believe, 5 years of research.
Yvonne Le Mau and the scientists at the University of Strasbourg hope that this approach will allow scientists to better track penguins and understand their travel and mating patterns, all without stressing the birds out. Here's something you might not have known about World War II. One of the most popular Hollywood actresses of the era was also developing weapon systems for the U.S. Navy. Today would have been the 100th birthday of a true Renaissance woman, Hedy Lamarr.
I was doing what I wanted to do, paying my own way and making my own rules.
Hedy Lamarr biographer Richard Rhodes said her acting career started when she was still a teenage schoolgirl in Austria.
Hedy's first starring role was in a film called Ecstasy, which was notorious because it involved full frontal nudity and simulated sex.
Rhodes says many sources get the year of her birth wrong because she told the studio she was born in 1913, not 14. Unlike many actresses, she made herself older.
In order to play this role, she had to be at least 16 years old. And in order to make that happen, she had to lie about her age because she wasn't.
After her scandalous turn in Ecstasy, she moved to Hollywood and signed a contract with MGM. They began promoting her as the most beautiful woman in the world. She hated that her image got top billing over her mind.
You know, it frustrated her terribly. She liked to say, "My beauty is my curse."
You know, you're a very lovely girl.
You're not being very scientific, Doctor.
She avoided the wild Hollywood lifestyle, often retreating into a life of the mind at home.
She had a drafting table installed and architect's lamps, and there was an entire wall of technical manuals of various kinds for references. And she would sit at her drafting table and invent things.
In 1940, she found inspiration. Lamar read about the deadly accuracy of German submarines. British and American naval technology was no match at the time.
So she focused on a particular problem, which was we had lousy torpedoes.
Their guidance systems were routinely inaccurate. Hedy Lamar imagined using radio frequencies to allow the submarine to talk to the torpedo, to guide it remotely.
The problem she focused on almost immediately was, what if a German ship tried to jam the radio signal?
To solve that problem, she was inspired by a relatively new invention, the remote control on the radio in her living room. You clicked a button from across the room, and the radio changed frequencies. If she could figure out how to allow the submarine and the torpedo to keep talking to each other while constantly changing frequencies, the Germans couldn't jam their signal.
And at that point, she was at a dinner party, and one of her fellow guests was a curious American avant-garde composer named George Antheil.
Antheil famously wrote this piece, Ballet Mécanique. The score called for 16 synchronized player pianos. You know, the players with the big scrolls of dotted paper inside. The pianos would automatically play the notes that corresponded with the holes that had been punched into the paper. Antheil figured that same technology could solve Lamar's problem. If you could scale this down to something tiny and get both the submarine and the torpedo to start their scrolls simultaneously,
the two could work in sync and jump from frequency to frequency. That's what Hedy called it, frequency hopping.
Hedy Lamar and George Antheil patented their invention and donated the patent to the U.S. Navy. The Navy brass was not impressed.
They said, what do you want to do, put a player piano in a torpedo? Get out of here.
But long after their invention was shelved and forgotten, it found new life. What Hedy Lamar called frequency hopping sparked the idea for spread spectrum technology.
It found application in car telephones. Bluetooth still uses frequency hopping. Military systems that went commercial, such as GPS, use frequency hopping for the uplink downlink to GPS systems.
Yep, that's right. You wouldn't have GPS or Bluetooth had it not been for Hedy Lamar. In 1960, she received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. It wasn't until this year, her 100th birthday, that Hedy Lamar would be inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Richard Rhodes' biography of Hedy Lamar came out in 2011. It's called Hedy's Folly. Since she was a wee girl, Bette Midler has delighted in listening to and singing along with girl groups.
My myth is to shame. Please let me explain. My myth is to shame means that you're vain.
That's her as Laverne and Maxine and Patty, all three Andrews sisters. On her new album, It's the Girls, Midler covers several decades of girl groups, from those tight harmonies of the 30s and 40s to the powerhouse Motown era, all the way to a fairly recent song, Waterfalls by TLC. Bette Midler says for her, this album is a love story. She fell in love with music through these songs.
Each one of them meant something to me. For some reason. By Mere Bistu Shane is a song my father used to sing to me. It's the Girl was the first 78 record I ever owned as a kid.
It isn't the paddle, it's not the canoe. It isn't the river or skies that are blue. It isn't the love dreams that bring joy to you. It's the girl. Oh, it's the girl.
And I had never heard music like that. I was very, very young, maybe 5 or 6 years old, but the sound of it was just mesmerizing to me. There were groups before that, namely the Boswell sisters, who really sort of set the bar for girl groups. And the Andrews sisters followed the Boswells, the Cordettes followed the Andrews sisters. So it really was a kind of a chronological thing. I did want to represent as many as I could. I did leave a few out. I know some people would say, why she left out the McGuire's? How dare she? But the McGuire's, I couldn't find a song that really resonated with me, you know, with a kind of, you know, a little bit on the rascally, mischievous side.
He's always wearing shades. Is he tall? Well, I gotta look up. Yeah, well, I hear he's bad. He's good bad, but he's not evil. Tell me more.
You know, it's funny, I was listening to those, and I kept saying, they remind me of something. What is it? And then I realized it's got the same kind of upbeat, fun vibe to it that Hairspray did. And then I realized that your musical collaborator is Mark Shaiman, who worked on Hairspray.
Yes, he wrote Hairspray with his partner, Scott Whitman. And he's an old friend of mine. He came to me when he was 16 years old. He knocked on my door. And he said, you don't know me, but I'm a musical prodigy, or words to that effect. And
modest.
I have to be in your world. I know exactly what to do with you. And I'm like, this kid is 16. Please leave me alone. And he never gave up, and he was incredibly persistent. And at one point, I turned to him, and he did deliver. He said to me, when I heard your first record, it lit a fire under me that nothing had ever done before, because you were singing so many different kinds of music that I had never experienced. And I immediately went out to the record stores, and I gave myself a musical education, and if it hadn't been for that first record of yours, I wouldn't have known any of that music.
But Mama said you can't hurry love. No, you just have to wait. She said love don't come easy. It's a game of give and take.
You sang the Supremes in country western. I was like, what?
What? That's what I said, what? Well, he brought me that, and I was like, I resisted, I have to say. But, you know, the Supremes are so iconic and so beloved. And it's a challenge to shine a different kind of a light on it. I mean, some of the songs like Come and Get These Memories, which I love Martha and the Vandellas, and I wanted to include them. But I would never touch a song like Heatwave, and I would never touch a song like Dancing in the Streets, because to me, those are the definite versions of that, those songs. They will never be improved upon.
Here's our old favorite record. Can't stand to hear it anymore.
This was so interesting, though, because you did not do the normal, you know, kick his junk to the curb, which was Martha's version, you know, like, I don't want it, come and get it, sucker, see you later. Yeah. This was really the way people feel when they have a bad breakup, especially when the breakup isn't your idea.
Because of these memories. But you.
Behind a lot of those lyrics, I felt that Come and Get These Memories was always a mini tragedy, you know? And I felt the same way about Waterfalls. The first time I heard it, I burst into tears.
A lonely mother gazing out of her window, staring at a son that she just can't touch. If at any time he's in a jam, she'll be by his side, but he doesn't realize he hurts her so much.
I understood it at a different level than maybe a lot of people heard it, because I had lost a lot of friends in the AIDS war, and I felt that it was the song of a mother. I thought it was a mother's song, when there really is literally nothing you can do. And there's nothing sadder. And, you know, that's really my benchmark. If I cry when I hear a song, I don't care who tells me I'm not going to sing it, I'm going to sing it.
Don't go chasing waterfalls. Please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you used to. I know that you're gonna have it your way or nothing at all, but I think you're moving too fast.
Speaking of tearjerkers, just one more time, I was looking at the old tape of you on Johnny Carson's last show.
Yeah.
The last broadcast of his last Tonight Show. I'm guessing he asked for you to be there, yes?
He did.
Did you choose the song or did he?
Well, I worked with Mark.
We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a sweet episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
From the civilian sitting in front of the television watching it point of view, it was really classy and heartfelt, and I have to say I was absolutely astonished to see Mr. Pokerface wipe his eyes after you sang to him, because he was so clearly moved and so clearly not wanting to lose it in the last few moments of his last show.
It was a highlight of my career, and it was a highlight for all of us. It was a we did what we set out to do, which was to express to him how much he meant to all of us who had come through his doors, that he had sent on our, you know, people that he had let fly. It was quite a feat. It was really a wonderful night. I'll never forget it.
For all of the years, for the laughs, for the tears, for the class that you showed, make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
That's Bette Midler. She's got a new album out. It's The Girls. It's a tribute to some of the girl groups that have inspired her over the years. Bette Midler, eternally divine, Miss M, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. James Earl Jones. From award-winning stage performances to the iconic voice that brought Darth Vader to life.
You are part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Take it away!
He's 83 years old and back on Broadway, starring in the comedy classic You Can't Take It With You. The play takes place in the midst of the Great Depression, a time when Jones himself was growing up in Mississippi and rural Michigan. He was close to his grandparents, who eventually adopted him, but he developed a stutter and remained quiet for much of his childhood.
You know, I've told that story so much, and I'm still fascinated by it because I don't understand it. I didn't want to talk. Bad enough that I just gave up. I couldn't introduce myself to people who visited the house, and it was too painful. I am still a stutterer, by the way. I don't say I was cured. I'm still a stutterer. I just work with it. Being raised as a farm kid, it was all about making do, putting one foot in front of the other. You had to plow a field. You just put the horse in the row and you got behind the plow and did a row at a time. And eventually you got it done, one foot in front of the other. And if you take a profession in this business, you got to accept that there's a certain journeyman stage to it. And for me, it never ends. I'm still a journeyman actor. But you're on a journey, and it's one foot in front of the other. I love the Army. I almost stayed in the Army. I was pre-med in college and couldn't handle that. I considered being a priest at one point. I'm glad I didn't do that. Training as an actor or performing, you gotta set your own time. And that's hard to do. Most jobs are 9 to 5. Janitoring was a job you could do at night. So janitoring was what I did. And I cleaned a lot of toilets. Some of the most famous off-Broadway theaters you can imagine, I washed the toilets in those places. I polished those toilets shiny. My Big Break, good Lord, what a title. My Big Break. Oh, I wouldn't like to say that. That puts down all the other things I've done that maybe really were my big breaks. Oh, yeah, I'll say it. My big break was the Great White Hope. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, you're the first black man in the history of the ring who's ever had a crack at the heavyweight title. Are you the Black Hope?
Well, I'm black and I'm hoping.
Answer him straight.
Hey, look, man, I ain't fighting for no race. I ain't redeeming nobody. My mama told me Mr. Lincoln done that. Ain't that why you shot him?
The Great White Hope. Put me, for instance, on the cover of Newsweek magazine. I said, that's something. One day of that week, somebody noticed you. I decided if I could handle a leading role in a Broadway play, then I can probably go ahead and get married and raise a family. I could afford to raise a family. At this point, I've become overwhelmed by how wonderful it's been. Because there was nobody supposed to be well known in our family. That was not supposed to happen, you know? Something odd about it. I think I'm very fortunate that I can earn a living doing something that I really find enjoyable. I like to keep doing it. And there's some plays I like to do still, some characters I like to explore. And there's always good actors to work with.
James Earl Jones. He's back on Broadway, starring in the award-winning comedy You Can't Take It With You. But hey, you don't have to be the voice of Darth Vader to have a big break. Send us your story, mybigbreak@npr.org. For the week ending November 9th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan. Our intern is Chloe Prosinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo de Aguila and Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Flickteig is our executive producer. I'm Karen Grigsby Bates. Arun Roth will be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.